last topic that I'd wanted to get to last week, but wasn't quite able to, is the relationship between prices and costs of production. A relationship implied, incidentally, by the uniformity of profit principle. The uniformity of profit principle states that there's a tendency toward a uniform rate of return on capital invested in all branches of the economic system. And in those branches in which the rate of return exceeds the general average rate of profit, there's a tendency toward stepped up investment resulting in expanded production, lower prices, profit margins, and rate of profit. And where there's a failure to earn the going rate of return, then the reverse developments occur. Now, in all of these instances, the implication is that whenever price exceeds cost by an amount that is more than sufficient to yield the going rate of return, when price exceeds cost by an amount that yields a premium rate of return, well, what is the uniformity of profit principle operating to do at that juncture?
Bring more people into the market that want
to sell. Expand the investment, the production, and do what to the price of the item and its relationship to cost?
Bring it down
so that the price will exceed cost by less than it did before, by an amount closer to what's implied by the going rate of profit. And where price fails to exceed cost by an amount sufficient to yield the going rate of profit, then the withdrawal of capital, the curtailment of production, the rise in price, profit margin, and rate of profit is bringing price up toward the point where it exceeds costs by an amount sufficient to yield the going rate of profit. So the uniformity of profit principle itself implies that prices tend to be governed by costs, not that they equal costs, but that they tend to exceed costs only by an amount of profit sufficient to yield the going rate of return, and must ultimately exceed it by at least that much. Now, in these cases, we have the relationship between price and cost established in an indirect way through variations in the supply, where the price is above cost by more than enough to yield the going rate of profit. Supply tends to increase, pull the price down. And where price fails to exceed cost by enough to yield the going rate of profit, then the decrease in supply operates to raise the price and the rate of profit. But there is also a direct relationship, very, very often, not universally, but very often, a direct determination of price by cost based on the decisions of sellers in setting their prices. This will apply to cases in which the ability exists to produce more of an item from existing productive facilities, from existing factories and equipment, in which supply can be expanded almost immediately from existing facilities, or reduced almost immediately by temporarily allowing inventory to build and then curtailing production from existing facilities. In these cases, as I think we discussed in our perhaps 2 weeks ago in discussing supply and demand, and particularly the case of horizontal supply curves, what's actually setting the price is the decisions of sellers based on a consideration of cost, whether it's their own cost or possibly the cost of less efficient competitors, the higher cost of less efficient competitors. In such case, the price would be set in a way that will not allow the less efficient competitors to make very much profit. It'll be set in a way that the more efficient competitors can make substantial profits based on their greater efficiency, but the less efficient ones will not be able to. The less efficient ones are not in a position to raise prices because the more efficient ones have capacity to spare and are in a position to take away too many of the customers of the less efficient ones should they raise prices. nor are the less efficient ones in a position to lower prices because the prices are already too close to their costs. So the large firms with capacity to spare are in a position to set price based on a consideration, if not of their own costs, the costs of their less efficient competitors. And in such a case, the less efficient competitors will only be able to make substantial profits if the demand for the item should increase so substantially that the more efficient competitors are simply unable to meet it from their existing capacity. If at a price based on cost, the quantity demanded exceeds the maximum ability to produce with the present facilities, then the price will rise and everybody in the industry will make money for the duration of that situation. But in a normal situation, the more efficient sellers have some capacity to spare and are in a position to limit the price. Now, whichever way we connect price to cost, whether it's via the indirect determination by cost through variations in supply, or this direct determination as I've just explained, anytime we seek to explain prices on the basis of costs, that is always a halfway house, because costs themselves always represent further prices. If we consider something like the cost of producing an automobile, even if it's true that the price of automobiles is governed by their costs, well, as soon as we start looking at the costs, we find that the costs break down into a sum of further prices times respective quantities, such as the wage rates of the different types of workers required in the auto plants, times their respective quantities of labor, the price of steel sheet, times the quantity of it going into an automobile, the price of the paint, the tires, etc. The cost of producing anything is always a sum of prices of means of production, including labor, times respective quantities. And to say a price is determined by cost implies, at least in major part, that one price is determined on the basis of other prices. Well, that is often true, but we still need to explain the further prices. An explanation requires that we explain a given type of phenomena by some other kind of phenomena, not the same type of phenomenon. So an ultimate explanation of prices can't be further prices, which is what's entailed in explaining prices on the basis of costs. And so we need to look further at what's determining the prices that constitute the costs. And as soon as we do that, we can observe that at any stage of production, a major portion of the prices that constitute costs are themselves determined by supply and demand. I think, is pretty clearly true of wage rates. Wage rates are not determined on the basis of cost of production. There are no factories manufacturing workers. The wage rates are determined by demand and supply. And that applies fundamentally even in situations in which wage rates in the first instance might be determined by union or governmental fiat. Suppose we have a union or the government stepping in and arbitrarily imposing some kind of wage rate. Virtually almost always this will be a wage rate higher than would have been set by the unhampered market. But even so, supply and demand is going to be operative, because what will happen to the quantity demanded? What happens to the quantity demanded at the wage rate imposed by a labor union? It'll be diminished compared to what it otherwise would have been. If the wage rate imposed by the union is higher, well, what do we know about the effect of higher prices, including higher wage rates, on quantity demanded? It'll be less, and the union will be setting a wage rate at which fewer workers of that kind can be employed. The pattern still follows demand and supply. What they've done is arbitrarily remove from the market the ability of part of the supply to compete. They've, in effect, eliminated part of the supply in their effort to drive up wage rates. And that part of the supply either ends up simply being unemployed, or if it is employed, it's employed somewhere else at lower wage rates. So wage rates are always determined in principle in accordance with demand and supply. And wage rates are by far the major element entering into costs, which becomes clear if we pursue matters back up the chain of production. Wage rates influence the price of automobiles, not only at the level of the auto plants, but insofar as they influence the price of steel. To the extent that the price of steel, which is itself a major component of the cost of producing automobiles, to the extent that that reflects the wage rates of the steel workers, well, wage rates are exerting a two-pronged influence on the cost of automobiles. There's the influence in the auto plants, then there's the further influence in the steel mills, and yet another further influence back in the iron mines, and anything else that directly or indirectly contributes to the production of automobiles. So as we look at matters in that light, we see a cumulatively greater role of determination of cost by wage rates, and wage rates themselves, I say, are determined by demand and supply. And then there are other elements of cost that are determined by demand and supply. For example, in a steel mill, a major item used in the production of steel is scrap iron. And the price of scrap iron is determined by demand and supply. A major element of cost in a flour mill would be the price of wheat or whatever other grain they're using. And that price is determined by demand and supply. The price of non-ferrous metals is typically determined by demand and supply. The price of crude oil is determined by demand and supply. Plywood, many other items. Anything for which you can find a regular price quotation in the commodities futures market. Those are prices determined by demand and supply. And such prices also play a major role in determining costs of production. And the cumulative role of these prices, as I say, becomes greater the further back in the production process we go. If we start with the cost of production of automobiles, well, we have wage rates and possibly other things that are determined by demand and supply. The price of the steel is likely determined on the basis of cost of production, but then what enters into the cost of production of steel?
Mining for the ore.
The ore, but wage rates of the steel workers, the price of scrap iron, and then, of course, the price of iron ore. Now, that itself might be determined by demand and supply, which would make the role that much greater. But if not, if it's determined on the basis of cost of production, then what elements of demand and supply figure into the cost of producing the iron ore? Certainly the wage rates of the iron miners, and there may be other things too. Now notice, suppose we had an auto firm that was vertically integrated, that was producing its own steel and mining the iron to go into that steel, and we were examining its cost of production, what would they consist of almost entirely?
Wage rates.
They'd be the wage rates paid in the auto plants, they'd be the wage rates paid in the steel mills, the wage rates paid in the iron mines, and such prices as scrap iron. A fully vertically integrated firm going back quite a few stages would have as almost its only cost wage rates, or wage rates plus some items like scrap iron. But the totality of its costs would be determined by insofar as they represented prices, they'd be determined by demand and supply. So, as I put it in point three, under the heading of prices and costs of production, a full explanation of prices based on cost, and of all prices, all other prices, prices that aren't based on cost, a full explanation of the prices that are based on cost, and of those prices that aren't based on cost, that depends on demand and supply. We have to explain prices based on demand and supply more fully than we have up to now. So that is where we start in the next section, the general pricing of goods and services in limited supply. We're out to explain what are common features determining the prices of all goods and services in limited supply. And what I mean by limited supply is a supply that cannot be enlarged for the time being, whose quantity, whose size is a given for some period of time. A supply that cannot be varied in response, that cannot be varied immediately in response to changes in demand. See, in the case of manufacturing and retailing and wholesaling, restaurants, typically the supply can be varied for all practical purposes just about instantaneously or almost instantaneously in response to changes in demand. I think I use the illustration, people go into a restaurant, they pick up a menu, and it's not the case that the restaurant is offering only a definite number of items, a definite number of units at the price it asks. If you go into McDonald's and they say $3.25 for a quarter pounder or whatever it is they're charging nowadays, does that mean they have five to offer at that price? And then they'll sell nine at $3.50 and 12 at $4? How many quarter pounders is a given McDonald's prepared to sell at the price up on its menu board? Up to the limit that they have on hand and can bring in from outside before having to turn away customers. Now, what determines the actual quantity that they sell on a given day? The quantity demanded at the price that they're asking. All right, now, this is not a case of limited supply. This is a case of immediately variable supply. And I say that's the typical situation in retailing, manufacturing, processing. But there are very important cases in which the supply cannot be varied in response to changes in demand. And my first topic here is a catalog, in quotes, a listing of such goods and services. The most important instance is human labor. We don't vary the quantity of people able and willing to work in response to changes in demand. At any given time, there are so many people able and willing to work. That places an overall limitation. There are fewer people able to perform skilled labor, still fewer able to work at the level of the professions, still far fewer who have been trained to any given skilled job or any given profession at any given time, and fewer still of any given job capability in any given geographical location. And then, of course, the supply of labor of every type is limited also by the fact that people desire leisure. And so it's not just how many people are around who might do the thing and how many hours they might be able to work. There's also the fact that they're generally not willing to work the maximum number that they would be capable of working. Well, this is why labor qualifies under the heading goods and services in limited or given supply. We don't turn them out of factories. Now, there are other things in this category also. Insofar as one piece of land has unique characteristics that differentiate it from other pieces, like there's only so much real estate at Hollywood and Vine, or 42nd Street and Broadway in New York, And to the extent that any piece of land has properties that render it unique, land is another element in a limited given supply. And then there are such things as agricultural commodities between harvests. Once the harvest comes in, that's the supply until the next harvest. We can't continually create these agricultural commodities. They're sporadic. There are also cases in which goods are not being produced that are needed, like scrap iron. We don't have anyone in the business of manufacturing scrap iron. That's a byproduct, and the supply is determined by how much is being scrapped of different things. There are all kinds of goods whose production is past, like first editions, paintings by old masters, rare books and coins. These are things that exist in a given limited quantity, and that's it. And then, as I indicated, anything can be in this position temporarily. Goods whose price may normally be determined on the basis of cost, if the demand is such that it outruns the ability to produce the item at a price based on cost, then the prices of such items become determined by their limitation of supply at the point of capacity operation. So what we want to do now is turn to an investigation of what is it that determines the prices of goods and services that exist in a given limited supply. And I think there are basically two determinants. One is the quantity of money in the economic system, and the other is the value judgments of the consumers, the value judgments of the consumers with respect to the various goods and services on which they spend the quantity of money. The quantity of money operates, affects its influence by determining the overall volume of spending. The larger the quantity of money in the economic system, the greater is the overall ability to spend money. Now, this is a factor that's operating to raise the prices of all goods and services in limited supply. If we have more money in the economy, that will operate to raise the demand for labor of all different types, for land of all different types, for agricultural commodities of all different types, for all goods and services in limited supply. And given their same supplies, it'll operate to make their prices higher. And then to the extent that other prices are determined on the basis of costs, well, these higher costs will operate to make the prices of the goods based on cost to make their prices higher as well. But there is another determinant of the prices of goods and services in limited supply, and that is, as I've said, the value judgments of the consumers with respect to the way in which they spend the quantity of money. And you can view it this way. The quantity of money is operating to determine the absolute height of all prices of goods and services in limited supply. If we double or triple the quantity of money, that will operate to double or triple the prices of all goods and services in limited supply. The value judgments of the consumers is operating to determine the relative heights of the prices of goods and services in limited supply. To illustrate this process, suppose for whatever reason the consumers were to decide that they wanted more products made of cotton and fewer products made of leather. All right, how would this affect the price of raw cotton versus the price of cow hides?
Cotton would increase.
I mean, the price of raw cotton would increase, the price of cow hides would decrease. So we can see a change in the valuations of the consumers would carry through to change the relative prices of the underlying factors of production in limited supply at any given time. And then going further than that, allowing for the fact that in the next year, the supply of cotton might be enlarged, the supply of cow hides might be diminished, in response to this change in their prices. Well, even so, what will be the effect of the rise in demand for cotton and cotton products on the price of land, especially suited for growing cotton? The price of such land would be higher, and what would be the effect on the price of that kind of land, which was especially useful in raising cattle?
That would go down.
That would go down. So notice a change in the value judgments of the consumers would change the relative prices first, scarce goods like cotton and cowhides, and then more fundamentally, the relative prices of the different types of land involved. Now, the same point would apply to determining such things as the relative price of real estate in St. Louis versus the relative price of real estate in Los Angeles. If, for whatever reason, people prefer to buy more products and services emanating from the Los Angeles area and fewer products and services emanating from the St. Louis area, how would you expect that to affect the price of real estate in Los Angeles versus St. Louis?
Increase in LA.
Increase in LA, decrease in St. Louis. Now, I think last week I went into the fact that it's the value judgments of the consumers that operate on the relative wage rates of different broad skill groups of workers. That's the same point as we're discussing here. The way I put it is under this head, the value judgments of the consumers determine the relative incomes of the different kinds of workers, the incomes of skilled workers in relation to those of unskilled workers, for example. And you can see that, again, if for whatever reason consumers were to prefer more products and services emanating from skilled labor and less emanating from unskilled labor, what would happen to the wages of skilled labor and what would happen to the wages of unskilled labor? If here we are, the consumers want more products and services that require more skilled labor, and they want fewer, the wages of skilled labor would go up, and the wages of unskilled labor would go down. All of the unskilled workers could continue to be employed. The demand for them would fall, but then what would have to happen so that the quantity demanded would again equal the same amount available? It would have to be a decrease in their wages. Then that would bring the quantity demanded back up, but their wages would be at a lower level. So this change in consumer valuations in this illustration would have increased the wages of skilled labor and decreased the wages of unskilled labor. Now a related way to approach the same point, I think hopefully we had some discussion a couple of weeks ago about the phenomenon of price sandwiching, that when there's something in a limited given supply, the market price has to be below the utility of the last unit purchased. Like if a million units of something are sold at a price of $10, if the quantity demanded is 1 million units at this price of $10, and that equals the supply available, well, the marginal utility of each and every one of the million units had to be greater than $10. Why wasn't a millionth and first unit sought by the buyers? Why did the potential buyer of the millionth and first unit abstain from attempting to purchase the item?
Marginal utility wasn't as high as
$10. For him, the marginal utility was below $10, which meant that the price of $10 was less than the marginal utility of the last unit, but greater than the marginal utility of one potential unit more. The price was sandwiched between those two marginal utility points. Well, that same point applies to any good or service in limited supply, and we can think of the prices of the different goods and services in limited supply as reflecting different sets of sandwich points, in effect. So if the price of oil at a given time is $50 a barrel and the price of gold is $420 an ounce or whatever, that indicates that ultimately the consumers are valuing a barrel of oil. They're valuing the last barrel of oil above $50 and one additional barrel more below $50. And similarly with gold at 420 or whatever. And so the relative prices of the goods and services in limited supply would be reflecting their relative marginal utility to the consumers. Now I'd like to turn to some major characteristics, some major work accomplished, major important results accomplished by the setting of prices of goods and services in limited supply in a free market. And the first of these, we'll discuss three significant attributes of what's accomplished in points 3, 4, and 5. And the first one I note is that, and it should be understood, we're talking about in a free market, in a free market, a market free of government intervention. The prices of goods and services in limited supply are set high enough, they're high enough to level down the quantity of the item demanded, to level it down or hold it down to or even somewhat below equality with the supply available. In a free market, it doesn't matter how limited the supply of something might be. One of the functions of a free market price is to be high enough to limit the quantity demanded to the supply available. And a major consequence of that is that shortages, even of such goods, even of goods that are available only in a strictly limited quantity, shortages of such goods are not possible in a free market. No matter how limited, the price will be high enough so that the demand will be limited to that supply. And we have certain things that are extremely limited. Gold is extremely limited. But do we have a situation of people able and willing to pay the market price of gold not being able to obtain gold? Why not? Because the price is high enough to limit the quantity demanded to the supply available. If potentially, if people went just by their heart's desire, well, I think most people would feel that gold is prettier than chrome. Why not use gold for automobile bumpers instead of chrome? Why not have goldware instead of silverware? Why not make things out of gold? Why don't we attempt to do that? Because the price is so high, and because it's so high, you couldn't sell it, so you don't attempt to do it. But if the price were not so high, suppose the price of gold were set down at the level of the price of copper. What do you think would happen to the quantity demanded of gold? The demand would be incredible compared to the supply. People would be wanting probably many thousands of tons, vastly more than was available. I point out also that by the same token, very similarly, the competition of the sellers of goods and services in limited supply prevents unsaleable surpluses in a free market. If sellers want to sell something, they can find buyers through what mechanism? What about the price? What must they do to the price?
To advertise it.
To find additional buyers.
Set the price below the marginal utility.
Set the price below the marginal utility of additional use. Bring down the price. If sellers want to sell, they can find buyers by reducing the price. There will be a low enough price to make the quantity demanded come up to equality with the supply available, assuming that the item has any positive marginal utility at all, that the full supply of it has any positive marginal utility at all. And I point out there's an implication of no mass unemployment in a free economy. There are no shortages in the sense of buyers seeking to buy something and not being able to find it. The price will be high enough so that those buyers able and willing to pay it will find it, because the other buyers will have stepped aside. And in a free market, there is no enduring problem of people able and willing to work and not being able to find jobs, because what will be the effect of lower wage rates on the quantity of labor demanded, and what's its effect on costs of production and the prices which are profitable, which you can at which you can sell goods profitably. What's the effect of lower wage rates on the quantity of labor demanded? There'll be more. And what's the effect of the lower wage rates on costs of production? Okay, what's the effect of lower costs on the prices that can be charged and still be profitable? They'll be lower, and people will buy larger quantities of goods at lower prices, and therefore there'll be a need for larger quantities of labor to produce the larger quantities of goods at lower prices. Now, I want to go into the fact that this is point four now, the setting of prices high enough to limit the quantity demanded to the supply, that this process is to the self-interest of the buyers as well as the sellers. And then we'll also try to show that it's to the self-interest of poor buyers as well as rich ones. Now, I don't think anyone has any trouble in understanding why the setting of prices high enough to limit the demand to the supply is to the self-interest of sellers. We know that other things being equal, sellers would like to obtain a higher price rather than a lower price. But I'm also saying that setting prices high enough to limit the demand to the supply is to the self-interest not only of the sellers, but also of the buyers, of those who actually succeed in buying. And let me approach it this way. Let's start with a relatively simple case. Imagine we're at an auction, and there is one unit being put up for bidding, and it's a rare first edition of this book. Okay, and we have two potential bidders, Brandon and Jim. And let's say Brandon is able and willing to pay up to $2,000, but he'd much rather pay only $200. Better than that, he'd prefer to pay $20, better still $2, or possibly even get it for nothing at all. Jim is able and willing to pay up to $1,000. Now, what will be the outcome if, when the auction opens, Brandon, because he prefers to pay $200 rather than $2,000, suppose he goes in and simply refuses to bid more than $200. What will happen? Well, who will end up with the book?
Jim
will get the book. Now, is that the outcome that Brandon wanted?
No.
Now, if he truly wants to get it, what must be the lowest price that he needs to pay?
More than a thousand, 1,001,
let's say. Now, this example has a major implication. It is that the rational self-interest of a buyer is not to attempt to pay the lowest price he could imagine or the lowest price he would desire, but instead the lowest price that is simultaneously too high for any other buyer who otherwise would have obtained the item instead of him. The rational self-interest of Brandon here is not to pay $200 or $20, but to pay $1,001. That would be the lowest price that would simultaneously be too high for his nearest rival, in this case, Jim. So that's the actual self-interest of a buyer is, I can't say it too often, I think, not to try to pay the lowest price he could imagine or would desire, but the lowest price that's simultaneously too high so that no one else gets the good instead of him. Now, suppose we didn't have an auction. We have this item being sold by a dealer, and the dealer will set the price. All right, well, what kind of price is it to Brandon's self-interest that the dealer have in his window?
$200.
Pardon me?
$200.
Over 1,000. Because if it's 200, then Jim can pass by, and Jim is off with the good, and it's then not there when Brandon wants it. If the good is to be available for Brandon, as and when he comes by, it's very much to his self-interest that the seller has set it high enough to keep it out of the hands of Jim. So it's the same point in an auction. His self-interest is to get the thing for the closest he can above Jim's maximum, and that would also be to his self-interest if the good is sold by a dealer. It's to his positive self-interest that the good be too high for anyone else to get to obtain it instead of him. Now let's make the example, let's vary it somewhat, and instead of having a case where we have just one unit of one item, let's assume we have a larger quantity, a larger supply, but it's still limited. I don't know if we used this illustration in the past. I know I do in the book. Suppose we have a case of a rare wine. Several thousand bottles of it can be produced per year, let's say 10,000 bottles a year, but its production is limited by the limited land required to produce precisely the kinds of grapes that will result in this wine that have the right combination of altitude, sunlight, temperature, wind, etc., whatever else goes into producing grapes. So the maximum quantity that can be produced in an average year is 10,000 bottles. But this wine might be absolutely fantastic tasting. Maybe it's much better than Coca-Cola. And potentially, millions of people would like to drink this wine, but there's only enough for 10,000 bottles. All right, and let's assume that in order to hold the quantity demanded down to 10,000 bottles a year, a price of $100 a bottle is required. So the ordinary soda drinker is not going to be in the market for this. All right, well, why is this $100 a bottle price to the self-interest of all those who value the wine at or above $100 a bottle?
Make sure that there'll be a quantity available.
Because it makes sure that it's available to them. If it's the case that at the price of $100 a bottle, there's 10,000 bottles demanded at the at a price of $50 a bottle, there'd be 25,000 bottles demanded. Well, if the price were $50, what would be the effect on the likelihood of those who value it $100 and higher finding the supply there when they went to buy it? It wouldn't be there. They couldn't obtain it. So whoever values the wine at or above $100 a bottle, it's to his self-interest that the price be set that high, because that's what serves to reserve the supply to them. If the price were lower, at least some of them would not be able to be supplied. Now, we've advanced beyond a single unit, but we're still at a very limited supply of units. And obviously, the buyers of this wine are likely to be fairly well-to-do, affluent people. And we have to develop the point further and show that this principle of the setting of prices high enough to limit the quantity demanded to the supply available, that this operates to the interest of everybody, not just the buyers of a handful of luxury items. And I want to try to show how it operates to the self-interest of poor buyers as well as rich buyers. Now, how is that? Well, let's deal with cases that where the supply is normally so abundant that virtually everybody is a consumer to some extent. Everybody is a consumer to some extent. Let us take rental housing. And let's make the assumption well, at any given time, there's only a limited number of rooms available, a limited number of apartments of a certain size. This is an example of something whose supply is a given, at least for the time being, until more buildings could be constructed. Now, for the sake of illustration, imagine that we have a market where the prevailing rents are $100 per month per room. I guess that sounds ridiculously low nowadays. We can change the numbers if you like. We can make it $500 per month per room. It's easier to work with 100, I think. Now, in this situation, a wealthy family, perhaps, will be renting an 8-room apartment. And a poorer family will be renting perhaps a 4-room apartment. Now, suppose we ask the question, why does this wealthier family that rents the 8-room apartment, why are they content with 8 rooms rather than go for a 9th room? Why don't they rent a 9-room apartment for $900 a month rather than just an 8-room apartment for $800 a month?
Marginal utility of the 9th.
Because their marginal utility, the marginal utility they attach to a 9th room is below $100. That's why they don't do it. Now, suppose we ask the same question of the poorer family. Why is it that they rent a 4-room apartment for $400 rather than limiting themselves to a 3-room apartment for
$300?
Again, they value their 4th room above $100. Now, this is an interesting outcome. It's showing... Here we have a case, the poorer family is valuing its marginal unit, is able and willing to pay $100 for its marginal unit. The wealthier family is not able and willing to pay $100 for its first sub-marginal unit, its 9th room. The poorer family is able and willing to pay more for its 4th room than the wealthier family for its 9th room. I think that's implied here. Now, who is it who outbids whom for the marginal room? The poorer buyer is able and willing to outbid the wealthier buyer for the marginal part of the supply in this case. See, it's not true that always, without exception, the wealthier buyers outbid the poorer buyers. That's reasonable to think if we're looking at things unit by unit. The wealthier family is able and willing to pay more for its 1st room than the poorer family. And if there were only 1 room, the wealthier family would get it. And similarly, they're able and willing to pay more for room 2 than the poorer family for room 2, and on and on and on. But they're not by any means necessarily willing and able to pay more for room 9 than the poorer family for room 4. And obviously there can be different cutoff points for different goods and different individual buyers. But the main point is that in all of the goods of mass consumption, poorer buyers are regularly, routinely able and willing to pay more for their marginal units than far wealthier buyers for additional units that would be submarginal to them. And such a principle has bearing on circumstances like a high price of gasoline and possible price control. Right now, there are many, many poorer buyers of gasoline and other oil products who are able and willing to pay more for their marginal units than substantially wealthier buyers are able and willing to pay for what are presently sub-marginal units to them. Now, suppose we were to have an oil, a greater scarcity of oil. The price of oil recently passed $50 a barrel. Who knows how much higher it could go. Certainly, if there's major upheaval in Nigeria, worse problems in the Middle East, who knows, maybe we can go to $75, $100 a barrel. And as it goes up, I think at some point, especially if one of the candidates wins rather than the other, you'll hear clamors for renewed price controls on oil and oil products. And part of that will be we have to have this to protect the poorer consumers. Well, now consider the implications of what I'm saying is that again and again, poorer buyers who have a more urgent need for something than wealthier buyers are in fact able and willing to outbid wealthier buyers for their marginal units. So if you have a poorer buyer who's vitally dependent on gasoline to get to his job or to make essential shopping trips, while a wealthier buyer could outbid him for gasoline for the same purpose, does it follow that the wealthier buyer is able and willing to outbid this poorer buyer if what the wealthier buyer is contemplating using the gasoline for is such a thing as a cross-country shopping trip or a joyride for his one of his teenagers? Now, if we have a price control and the item is within the reach of more buyers than there is supply, well, isn't it very possible that the wealthier buyer with a less urgent need is in a position to go on satisfying his less urgent need with the gasoline that the poorer buyer could otherwise have successfully obtained by being willing to bid a higher price? I think that follows. So it's certainly not the case that having a price control on gasoline would be to the interest of the poorer buyer if that means that it permits gasoline to be obtained by other people needing it for less urgent purposes, and then it's unavailable to this person when he needs to have it. So from this perspective, the free market price is to the self-interest not only of wealthier buyers, but also of poorer buyers. They too are buyers, and they need to limit an expansion in quantity demanded on the part of others, which, if successful, would deprive them of urgently needed supplies. Now, I need to say a little more about the cases of luxury consumption. What about the rare wines, the scarce, valuable books or great works of art, Rembrandt paintings, etc. Now, you and I have no hope of ever successfully winning an auction for a Rembrandt painting or anything of that kind. And that is something reserved to a very, very narrow circle of enormously wealthy bidders. Can anyone think how even though the wealthier bidders are going to be the ones, the only ones, who are successful in those instances, how does this arrangement, nevertheless, all things considered, if you hold a broader context, how does this still operate to the material self-interest of poorer people as well, of everybody? Let me make it a little more concrete. How is it to my self-interest that I don't have a prayer of out-competing Gates for Galileo's manuscript or whatever it was that he bought a few years ago, or Rembrandt paintings or whatever? I have no prayer of ever obtaining those goods in competition with people like him. So they're exclusively in their province. How does that help me? Yes, Ms. Fox.
Is he spending the money on the luxuries, or will he be able to spend your money on the necessities?
He's getting luxuries, that's true, and what is the fact that he's able to satisfy his desire for such luxuries? What does that keep him doing that is a benefit to me and you and everybody else?
He keeps producing so that he can have the material wealth.
He keeps working and producing. That's something that he considers worth having. He wants to have, it motivates him to produce. And what is produced is then things that are of benefit to the average person in the society. So the fact that multimillionaires can have their Rembrandts and whatever, that is what motivates them to go on producing and improving the products and methods of production, and enables the average members of the society to have a growing supply of all types of other goods and a growing degree of lesser luxuries. So I would say if we had an arrangement whereby everybody had an equal access to all goods, that I had as good a chance of getting these Rembrandt paintings or whatever as Gates and the other billionaires, then what would be left to motivate them? And if they didn't have motivation, where would we all be? We'd be an awful lot poorer than we are. So the ability of prices to be high enough to limit the demand to the supply is operating ultimately to progressively enlarge supplies, even in these cases in which the supplies are extremely limited and always will be. Now, yes.
Doesn't his interest, Gates' interest in the rent grant, have an impact on his interest in things that you would be wanting to purchase?
Doesn't Gates' interest in Rembrandt's also have an impact on things that I might be interested in purchasing? Yes, you could say that too. Suppose here Gates will spend many millions buying a Rembrandt. Conceivably, he could have used the same money in a different way and have sought and have elevated prices of things that other people buy. If, for example, for some reason he wanted to have 1,000 extra rooms in apartment buildings, and well, that would raise apartment rents. So it's better from the point of view of prospective tenants that he buy the Rembrandt rather than raise their rents, so one could say that. But notice, everyone's financial means, however great, are limited. Whatever Gates' income, it might be $1 billion a year or more, he can only spend up to the total of his billion. And he cannot deprive other people of the ability to spend their thousands or tens of thousands. So there's always things for everyone to buy to the extent of the money they earn. Now, I want to note briefly, still under point four, the setting of prices low enough to clear the market is to the self-interest of sellers as well as buyers. This is developing things along the lines of a parity, P-A-R-I-T-Y, with the self-interests of the buyers lying with the sellers setting prices high enough. Now we also see that the self-interests of sellers can lie with setting prices low enough to clear the market. There are two aspects of this. One is lower prices will almost always enlarge the overall market. The lower the price, the larger the quantity demanded. So it makes it possible for sellers to sell more. And there can be sellers who haven't been able to sell anything and who will now be able to if they lower the price. People, particularly people who are unemployed, if they're free to bid down wage rates, they can create a place for themselves. But then also, there are very often cases in which some sellers cutting their price will cause other sellers to withdraw from the market. Imagine we have a situation where there's been a sharp drop in the demand for something, and the immediate effect of this sharp drop in demand is to leave a bunch of producers operating at a fraction of their normal capacity. Let's say we have a whole bunch of producers suddenly operating at 50% of capacity. Now, if it's the case that some of these producers with idle capacity have operating costs that are below the price still being received by other sellers who are making sales, if they cut the price and the price that they charge goes below the operating cost of some of the sellers presently making sales, what will those sellers have to do?
Either drop the cost or get out of business.
Either cut their costs or abandon that market. They have to. If we have a situation, we have one seller whose operating cost is $10 a unit, another seller whose operating cost is $25 a unit, and they're both suddenly put in a position in which they're selling only half of what they had been selling, and the price is $30 per unit. If the prevailing price had been $30 per unit, allowing the $25 operating cost producer to make some profit, and now they're both operating at half capacity, and one firm has half of its $10 capacity idled, the other firm is still employing half of its $25 capacity, well, that first firm may have a very powerful advantage in putting the price below $25. If it does that, then it deprives its rival of profitability. It makes him incur a loss on that part of his capacity, and it opens up the market to his capacity. He can operate much more fully at a price below 25 because it displaces the capacity of the higher cost producer, and at the same time will operate to enlarge the overall total quantity demanded. So in such a situation, the price reduction is to the self-interest of the seller as well. And a wage reduction would be to the self-interest of workers who otherwise would be unemployed and who then are able to find jobs. Now, let me turn to point five, namely in a free market, goods and services in limited supply are distributed to consumers in accordance with a combination of their wealth and income and needs and desires. A combination of their wealth and income, needs and desires. Well, we can use the wine case as an illustration, also the products of crude oil, or anything actually. Take that case of the wine that sells for $100 a bottle. Now, other things being equal, we'd expect it to go to wealthier, higher income buyers. But suppose we have a wealthier, higher income buyer who's also a teetotaler. And we have a lower income, poorer buyer who's a wine connoisseur. Well, isn't it entirely possible that the lower income, poorer buyer in such circumstances is able and willing to outcompete the higher income, wealthier buyer? Yes. So what emerges from this kind of case is that other things being equal, if the buyers had the same scale of tastes and preferences, if they all valued wine relative to alternative goods in the same way, then the supply would just go to the wealthier, higher income buyers. But if you have buyers who have different needs and desires with the same means, if you have buyers with the same financial means, the same wealth and income, then which ones will the supply go to?
Person with the higher margin to it?
Yeah, those who attach the greater value to it. If we have a series of buyers who are in the same, who possess the same wealth and income, the ones who value something more highly will obviously outbid the ones who value it less highly. Now, in reality, we have people with different degrees of wealth and income, and also different tastes and preferences. And in a free market, the goods and services in limited supply will end up in the possession of people based on a combination of these two elements. So very often, buyers of lower wealth and income who value the thing exceptionally highly will outbid buyers of substantially greater wealth and income who value it at a much lower degree. And this is apart from the issue of higher valuation at the margin. We already saw that poorer buyers are again and again able and willing to bid more for their fourth room or other unit than wealthier buyers for their ninth room or other unit, or the gasoline they need to get to work compared to the gasoline a wealthier, higher income buyer needs for a joyride. So these market prices take into account relative wealth and income, and also relative needs and desires. All right, now everything we've said up to this point applies to the prices of all goods and services in limited supply. And what I want to do now is start zeroing in specifically on the prices of factors of production in limited supply. And as I explain in the same point, factors of production are labor, materials, and machinery bought for business purposes. i.e. for the purpose of earning profits through subsequent sales. Those are the factors of production. And insofar as the factors of production are in limited supply, their prices have the same characteristics and the same significance as the prices of consumers' goods in limited supply, as we've just described under points 3, 4, and 5. Namely, they are set in a free market high enough to level the quantity demanded down to equality with the supply available. Also, the setting of prices at that point is to the self-interest of the buyers as well as the sellers. I'll just take note of one particularly important case. The setting of wage rates high enough to limit the quantity of labor demanded to the supply available is to the self-interest of employers, not just the wage earners. It's against the self-interest of employers to attempt to offer too low wage rates, just as it would be against Brandon's self-interest to bid too low a price for the rare first edition, because such behavior enables labor to be employed by others and to be unavailable to them. We'll say a lot more about this later in the term. And also, as we'll see, the benefit of the supply of the factors of production in limited supply, the benefit goes to consumers in accordance with a combination of their wealth and income and needs and desires. For illustration, the benefit of the supply of grain goes to buyers in accordance with a combination of their wealth and income and specific need and desire for grain products. So other things being equal, a wealthier individual will be able to obtain the benefit of a larger share of the supply of grain than a poorer buyer. Not that he eats more bread, but he may be eating more steak and drinking more scotch, both of which can be or are produced with the aid of grain. But by the same token, a poorer buyer with an especial fondness for steak and scotch is in a position to outbid wealthier buyers who don't have such a special fondness. So the benefit of the supply of grain, of skilled labor, of unskilled labor, of everything in a limited supply ends up going to the ultimate consumers in accordance with a combination of their wealth and income and specific individual needs and preferences. Now, it's important to note, I think, that the price of a factor of production in limited supply does double duty in a sense. It operates to limit the quantity of it demanded to conform to the supply of it available, and also as part of the cost of production of its products carries through and determines the price of the products and operates to limit the quantities demanded of the products to conform with the supply available of it. Let me give an illustration of this. I will take the simplest case where we have a factor of production with essentially just one use, let's say cigarette tobacco, leaf tobacco. The only product of this tobacco is cigarettes. Now, the price of tobacco leaf will be high enough to limit the quantity demanded of tobacco leaf to conform to the supply of tobacco leaf, but also, as a major component of the cost of producing cigarettes, it will carry through to the price of cigarettes and operate to limit the quantity demanded of cigarettes to conform to the limited supply of tobacco leaf. So that's the double duty. The price of a factor of production in limited supply is serving to limit the quantity demanded of it and also the quantity demanded of its products to conform to its limited supply. If we have, as is more common, a factor of production with multiple products, like grain or crude oil, the price of grain will be high enough to limit the quantity demanded of grain to conform to the supply of grain available, but also will carry through in determining the cost of production of bread, crackers, pasta, and all other wheat products to limit the quantities demanded of them to conform to the supply of grain. The price of crude oil constitutes a major component of the cost of producing gasoline, diesel fuel, heating oil, etc., and operates to limit the quantity demanded of crude oil to conform to its limited supply, and also the quantity demanded of the various oil products as a group to conform to the limited supply of crude oil available. Now, there's a further aspect that pertains to prices of factors of production that is not present in consumer goods, and this is what I describe under point 7. Factors of production in limited supply have an added dimension of distribution. Not only is there benefit distributed, as we've described, to the consumers in accordance with a combination of their wealth and income and needs and desires, but also there's a distribution or allocation of the factors of production in limited supply to their various concrete uses or employments. So the supply of crude oil has to be distributed to the production of gasoline, the production of heating oil, the production of butane, propane, etc., etc., all the different oil products. The supply of wheat has to be distributed to the production of bread, crackers, pasta, whiskey, whatever. And I point out in the last sentence of this point, this kind of distribution of a factor of production among its various products takes place through a process of the different needs, desires, and purposes of one and the same individual consumers bidding against each other. This process of allocating such a thing as the supply of wheat between the production of bread, the production of crackers, etc., this is carried out in accordance, ultimately, with a process of the bidding among the different needs, desires, and purposes of one and the same individual consumers. And let's show how this is the case. Suppose we ask the question, why aren't a million bushels of wheat, let's say, removed from the production of crackers and added on to the production of bread? This would certainly be a physical possibility. What stops it from happening? Why isn't it just arbitrarily happening? I mean, it's an issue of the demand for the two products. Now, let's assume we could sell the resulting bread, the additional bread that would result from using an extra million bushels of wheat to produce bread. But what would have to happen to the price of bread to find buyers? It might have to go down very precipitously. Maybe the extra quantity demanded would take place with old ladies feeding pigeons in the park. Would take a very steep drop. Now, in order for it to be profitable for the bread bakers to expand their production in a way that used an additional million bushels of wheat, what kind of price of wheat would they need in order to be profitable at the very low price of bread that would be needed to move the resulting bread? They'd only be willing to take that extra million bushels of wheat at a very sharply lower price of wheat in order to make profitable the sale of the resulting extra bread. But what kind of price of wheat is the cracker industry prepared to pay for that same million bushels of wheat that it presently uses? It's prepared to pay the present prevailing price of wheat. So the cracker industry, for this marginal million bushels of wheat, is prepared to pay the present prevailing price of wheat. The bread baking industry would be prepared to take that wheat, but only at the radically lower price of wheat that would be needed to make it profitable to sell the resulting extra bread. So which industry outbids which for this particular million bushels of wheat? The cracker industry. And what is it that allows the cracker industry to outbid the bread industry for this million bushels of wheat? Why is the cracker industry profitable paying the present price of wheat, and the bread industry could only be profitable paying the sharply lower price?
Because the cracker industry has a higher price if they can afford to pay the higher price.
Who is ultimately permitting this? Who is ultimately the consumers of crackers are prepared to pay prices for crackers, which make it profitable to produce crackers with the present price of wheat. The consumers of bread would only be prepared to offset the use of the additional wheat to bake bread at a radically lower price of bread. So the way this ends up is indirectly. It's the consumers of crackers who indirectly could be said to outbid the consumers of bread for the use of this wheat. The consumers of crackers are willing to allow cracker prices that enable the cracker industry to pay the present price of wheat. The consumers of bread are not willing to allow bread prices to cover such grain prices. And so it's the consumers of crackers in the last analysis who outbid the consumers of bread in determining the use of this wheat. And if we ask a related question, why aren't a million bushels of grain taken off of bread baking and added on to cracker making, reversing the process?
Same reason.
That would be essentially the same reason. The buyers of bread are prepared to pay prices for the present quantity of bread that covers the present price of wheat. The buyers of an additional quantity of crackers would only be willing to buy them at a sharply lower price. So the cracker industry is not able to outbid the bread industry for a million bushels added onto crackers. In both cases, it's the consumers of the ultimate products, the bread and the crackers, who are determining the allocation of the scarce factor of production. Now, I say that the allocation of these factors of production is the result of a competition among the different needs, desires, and purposes of one and the same individual consumers, because in the overwhelming majority of cases, any given individual, to some extent, is a buyer of bread and also a buyer of crackers. Also a buyer of pasta. Almost everybody is buying pretty much the whole range of the products of this factor of production, and its allocation among the various possible uses is the result of a competition among the buyers, among the same individuals, among their different needs, desires, and purposes. Now, in point eight, I state that in a free market, factors of production in limited supply are distributed to their most important uses in accordance with the pattern of consumer spending. Well, I think that is already established in our discussion of point seven. Why is wheat allocated the way it's allocated and not more added on to bread at the expense of crackers or vice versa? It's based on consumer spending, based on what the consumers want. It's the supply is allocated in a way that the consumers consider most valuable. We don't add more to certain uses and have less for others because the consumers are valuing the expanded uses below the uses from which the supply is withdrawn. Now, it's also necessary to realize, and this is point nine, that the concept most important uses of a factor of production is a variable range. It's a variable range whose extent is determined by the supply of the factor. The most important uses of the supply of wheat is something very different in the dark ages, or still today in many parts of India, than it is in the United States. What are the most important uses of wheat in a miserably impoverished country?
Basic.
Providing the bare minimum of food. That's its essential, most important use. What do the most important uses of wheat embrace in a society such as ours, where we have vastly more than enough to produce all the bread that people want, and pasta and so forth? What further uses are embraced by the concept most important uses of the supply of weed. To some extent, making whiskey, raising meat animals, grain-fed meat animals. It's the same principle, if you think back to our discussion weeks ago of the principle of marginal utility. What are the most important uses open to sacks of grain? That's a variable range determined by the number of sacks at that pioneer farmer's disposal. So if there were only one sack available, what's the most important use for a sack of grain with one sack available? Bare survival. What are the most important uses of a sack of grain when there are five available? I mean, extending on down to feeding the pet parrot. So now that is the most important use for the fifth sack. That's the most important use for the fifth sack. Now, in a context such as we have, with very, very large supplies, the most important uses go far beyond the utmost important uses. They embrace uses of progressively less importance, but it's the most important uses commensurate with that supply. And such things as using grain to make some alcohol, using grain to feed livestock, those are the most important uses, among the most important uses, given our present supplies. Let me consider which would be more important, having less grain-fed beef and producing more bread that people just don't want to eat. What's the most important use from your point of view of where the grain goes insofar as it serves to make possible your consumption? If you're not a vegetarian,
Feeding the animals
is more important than having additional bread when you already have all the bread you want. Or making some alcohol products that can be more important. Now, as I say, this concept of most important uses is a variable range, and the larger the supply, the less important are the uses that qualify as most important. They're most important for the available supply, in the light of the available supply. And now notice further, and now returning to point 10, the prices of factors of production in limited supply are determined with respect to their marginal uses. They're determined with respect to their marginal uses. That is the least important of their most important uses. So this means, for example, the price of grain is determined in our situation by the importance of grain in feeding meat animals or in making alcoholic beverages. It is not determined by the importance of grain in providing the bread to still people's hunger. The price of grain is set with respect to a much lower level of marginal utility. Similarly, the price of iron ore is set with regard to the utility of its marginal products. What sorts of things might be the marginal products of iron ore? What are some things that perhaps would qualify as the least important things we produce given our present supply of iron ore, the least important among the most important? What would be some marginal employments for iron ore? Do you think surgical instruments would qualify? No, I wouldn't think so. What might qualify?
Toys.
Possibly toys. What about bells on bicycles, baskets on bicycles? There are varying things. Now, the price of iron ore, or whatever, has to be low enough to make it profitable to use it in all of its employments. The price of iron ore needs to be low enough to make it profitable to use it in all of its employments. The price of wheat needs to be low enough to make it profitable to use it in all of its employments. So if wheat is going to be used to feed cattle to some degree, it has to be low enough to make it profitable to do that. It has to be low enough so that those who use grain to raise cattle can sell their meat at a price that moves the meat and is still profitable in the light of the price of grain. And notice also, at the same time, in the same market, there's one price paid for the same factor of production. There's one price paid for the same factor of production. So the buyers of iron ore that are going to be used, the parts of the iron ore supply that will be used to make surgical instruments, they're not paying any more for their iron ore than the buyers of the iron ore used to make bicycle bells or baskets. The buyers of grain to bake bread to still people's hunger is not going to be any higher than the price of the grain paid by those who are feeding it to meat animals. So we've got the prices of the means of production in limited supply set low enough to make it worthwhile to use them in their marginal employments. And then these prices, insofar as they constitute costs of production and govern the prices of products, they're governing the prices of products at a level conforming to the value of the marginal products. To use some illustrations that I think we may have used, what is the direct marginal utility, do you think, of a fan belt in your under the hood of your automobile? As great as the whole automobile. Do you have to pay a price that comes up to the direct utility of the fan belt?
No.
What kind of price do you pay for the fan belt? Something radically lower. The price of the fan belt is being governed by the cost of producing the fan belt, not by the marginal utility of the fan belt. But the prices that constitute the cost of producing the fan belt, they're being governed by what? Insofar as they reflect things in limited supply. You don't have to reach for something out of the blue. Try to relate it to material we've just been discussing. Well, it'll be based on the prices of the factors of production in limited supply, which are governed by their value in which of their employments. Yeah, the marginal employments. The price of a fan belt reflects the value of the factors of production required to make the fan belt in their marginal employments, not in the employment of keeping your car functioning. That would be a $20,000 employment, perhaps. That's not what is setting the value. The value is being governed by the value of the marginal products of whatever it takes to make a fan belt, products of much, much lower importance. You see, here we are, we have a set of connections. The price of the fan belt is governed not by its own direct utility. It's set at a much, much lower point on the basis of its cost of production. But the prices that constitute the cost, they're set on the basis of demand and supply, ultimately. And the full supplies, it has to be profitable to use the full available supplies. So those prices that will end up setting the cost of producing the fan belt, they have to be low enough to make the elements that go into the fan belt worthwhile to use in their marginal employment. The value of the marginal products of the factors needed to produce the fan belt is setting the cost of producing the fan belt, and the cost of producing the fan belt is governing the value of the fan belt. Now, there might be occasions when you'd have to pay for a fan belt your actual marginal utility of it. If you wanted to get out of a country like Iraq before Saddam Hussein, or maybe even now, if you wanted to get out and you've got a broken fan belt and your life is at stake unless it's fixed, well, you'd be willing to pay anything you had. But normally, the prices of these acutely valued products is normally set on the basis of their cost of production, which is much, much lower. But the cost of production reflects the value of marginal products, maybe physically very, very different kinds of products in totally different sorts of uses. So, as I put it, consequently, prices determined by cost of production are determined with respect to the marginal uses of the factors of production. And finally, point 11, all prices of goods and services in limited supply are determined by the consumer's value judgments with respect to marginal quantities, for example, rental space. Rents have to be low enough so that pretty much the full supply of rental housing can find tenants. And in order for that to happen, it has to be below the valuations of the marginal tenant, the marginal valuations of the tenants for the marginal rooms. Okay, I don't know how clear you found this. I hope between the class and the reading, it's making some significant sense to you. If you have any problems, please formulate them, and when we come back from the break, please, by all means, raise your questions, and then we'll go on to further material. So I'll see you all in 25 minutes.